As it happens, I have an illustration here I wanted to read to you, but I pulled my papers out. And so where the illustration was has become lost to me in this book. So I'm going to try and buy some time here so I can find it, because I wanted to begin with that, and maybe I won't be able to. So what do you remember, if I can ask you this question, what do you remember about what we talked about last week? Anybody? What do you recall about what we talked about, Philippians chapter 2, as it relates to oneness? And what about that? How does Paul sort of begin in chapter 2 the idea of oneness? Why does he say that's important for us to do? I'm sorry, go ahead. Promoting, why is oneness important in terms of promoting the gospel?
You all have one mind, like mine.
Okay, one mind, yeah. But what does oneness do apart? What does oneness do for us in terms of promoting the gospel?
Fellowship.
Fellowship, that's true. What does it do for us in terms of the world in which we live? Anybody remember? What does oneness do? What does Jesus have to say in John chapter 17 about oneness? Ha, I found it. See how well I bought all that time? But I'm serious though. What does oneness have to do? According to John chapter 17, what does oneness have to do with us in the world, we in the world? John chapter 17, he says, I pray, Father, in his high priestly prayer, I pray, Father, that they might all be one in order that the world might know that the Father has sent the Son. So he says that twice in John chapter 17. His high priestly prayer, among the last words that Jesus says, he coalesces so much of his teaching in terms of what he expects of believers and his disciples in John chapter 17, and he sort of sums it up, and he says, and he talks about the enemy and all that kind of stuff and what the enemy wants to do, but then he says, and I pray that they might all be one in order. He says, I and the Father are one. I am in you, you in me, they are in us. So there's a certain sense in which the same way in which the Trinity is one, that we are to be one. That you can have three distinct persons who have different personalities who live in oneness and unity with each other in a perfect manner. And that is no less the calling for us. That is the goal. Is it possible? No. Does it exist in matters of degrees? Yes. And the better the degree, the better it is for the world. Because the world sees the church functioning as one, and they are inspired by that. Because we know, don't we, that there's so much conflict in the world. I mean, have you not ever been in one situation where you saw a family, for example, and you always understood that family to be really united? They just seem to have their act together as a family. They seem to genuinely love each other. Then something happened, and it's like they hated each other. And you thought, you're stunned. I would have never thought that that family was capable of that kind of a... But even in families, even in marriages, regardless, if you're going to have two people in a room long enough, you're going to have problems. Because we have difficulty getting along with each other. So I want to begin, before I even get to the text... I want to begin by, and I've used this story before, but it's been a number of years since I read this story. This is a true story. I'm sure there are some embellishments. It was written to sort of elicit some humor, but the story as a whole is true. It happened a number of years ago, and I just want to take the time and read it to you and let you enjoy it as much as you can enjoy it. And as I do, I mean, for example, if I were to ask you the question, if you were to go back over time and think about all the examples of wacky reasons why people fight in the church, or people within the Christian community don't get along. So I remember years ago, the first church I ever had, which was in Elwood City, my wife was what was called the Sunday school superintendent. So in the old time, sort of like Alliance Baptist Church and stuff, they had a thing called the Sunday school superintendent. And they sort of ran the Sunday school. And then afterwards, there were sort of like where everybody came back in and they had like opening exercises, you know. And so my wife did that. Well, we were short on time or something like that. I can't quite remember. And she omitted one part of the opening exercises that involved grandchildren and children coming up and putting money in the missionary box right up front here. So not thinking, being aware of what everything that was involved, she omitted it to save some time. And so afterwards, she was approached, accosted by one of the saints, the older saints in the church, and told her that she was going to get herself into trouble by arbitrarily making big choices and decisions like that without taking it before the board. It gives you an idea how big the church was. And so she just sort of like, you know, dressed her down a bit. So Ruth came home and she told me, really? I said, you just took one thing out and, you know, maybe we shouldn't have done it, but maybe a better way would have said, hey, you might be aware that these are some of the things that are going on. And so if you make a decision like that, just understand that some people really like to see their grandchildren and children walk up front in their Sunday finery and put the money. It's really about seeing their grandchildren going up front as opposed to about the money going in the missions box, you know. And so her name was Dot. She went by Dot. So I called Dot up and I said, hey, Dot. My understanding is that there was this, you know, sort of misunderstanding about this particular thing, and there was no ill will intended, and I just think that maybe you just came on a little strong. So you want me to apologize to her? Well, I think that would be a nice thing to do. All right. So she called my wife up. Hello, Ruth. Yes, this is Dot. Okay. I guess I'm supposed to apologize to you. Just like a kid, yeah. So consider this an apology, click, okay? So then Dot called me up and said that she called Ruth. And I said, oh, well, that was nice, thank you. And, before she hung up on Ruth, she said, consider this to be your apology. And then she said, next time, fight your own battles, click. So, and then this isn't how things are supposed to be, right? I mean, in the church, if we're gonna die on a hill, it better be a good hill to die on, don't you think? Right? And it's always good to give people the benefit of the doubt, don't you think that too? Like, you know, like most people don't wake up in the morning and think, how can I drive the saints in the church crazy today? What can I do to make their life miserable, you know? And there are people like that. You know, look, there are a lot of people in the world today who spend the rest of their lives being miserable, right? And they just are that way. And there's some of them are in the church, and so we have to sort of corral them a little bit, and maybe not give them as much face time as they want to have. But when we talk about how we, and so Paul was concerned about these things in Philippians 2. In fact, for him, in addressing this in Philippians, this was sort of like the cherry on top. He was trying to nudge them further in terms of their Christian maturity by them imitating Christ in terms of how they served each other, because there was conflict in the church between Euodia and Syntyche. And I don't think Euodia and Syntyche get enough attention when we talk about the book of Philippians. There was something going on between two house churches that was causing conflict, so much so that it reached all the way back to Paul, where he was writing a letter. So as I was reading that, it reminded me of this story. And so I just want to spend a little bit of time kind of having fun. But I think that, you know, I think that you'll appreciate this as a kind of a metaphor for the church in general. So there was a situation where there were some people in this church who didn't like the pastor anymore. Call me crazy. I think that happens on occasion, but that's what was happening here, right? And so they were trying to call a special board meeting to vote him out. There was another group of people who wanted to keep the pastor, and so they would not hold the vote in order to have, they wouldn't hold the board meeting in order to have the vote. And so, in order to be true to the bylaws, a public announcement needed to be made, and that's where we're sort of getting to in this particular situation. So, very quickly, the church divided into two hostile groups. Those who felt the pastor should be removed began sitting on the left side of the church, and on the right side sat members who wanted to give him more time. The choir was split and given to vacillation. The organist sided with the pastor, and the church secretary didn't want to get involved. Flora Waite resigned from her position as assistant director of the Dorcas Society after one of the ladies commented that blackmail was far worse than gossip, whatever that means. Offertory envelopes contained more than tithes. Routinely, they were dropped off on the collection plate imprinted with a particular dogma. Wait no longer, read some. Others declared, support the pastor. And there was always one proclaiming, the organ is too loud. Again, you know, I've never been in a church where music was an issue, but apparently it was here too. So the deacons began to sit as a group on the left side of the church, pressing together in the front pew. In the past, one of the deacons had always made the morning announcements. But ever since the weekend of the potluck, Pastor Waite had read the announcements himself, each time omitting the board's call to a special assembly to vote for him or to vote him out. For 4 weeks, he simply kept the meeting from being announced. On the third Sunday in May, he was apparently going to do the same thing. Connecting the lapel mic to his suit, Waite solemnly stepped down in front of the wooden communion table with its ornately carved command, "Do this in remembrance of me." "If anyone is visiting us today," he began, "please raise your hand and our ushers will come by and give you some information about Emmanuel Baptist Church." At that point, Frank Fowler got up from the front pew and strode up the stairs of the platform to the pulpit. Bending toward the microphone, he smoothed out a piece of paper and started to read. "This is to announce a special congregational assembly for this afternoon to discuss Pastor Donald Waite." Suddenly, he could not be heard. Flora Waite, at the piano, had begun pounding out "Have Thine Own Way," and was immediately joined by Cheryl Carson on the organ, drowning out the rest of Frank's message. Pastor Waite began singing loudly into his lapel microphone, and some on the right joined him. Before they could begin the second verse, Frank pulled the organ power from the wall, and Brian McGuire shut the piano lid. Flora Waite beat on his arms for a minute and even lost her hat in the scuffle, but Brian held on. There was an awkward pause. Deacons still in their seats coughed nervously and crossed their legs. Most of the choir was leaning forward, and one of the tenors was taking notes. Then Ray Bryson got up and walked over to the pastor in a slow, deliberate way that one approaches an injured animal. The veins on Ray's neck were showing as the two men hissed under their breath at each other. After a minute, Ray appeared to be satisfied. He turned to go to his seat, but his feet were tangled in the microphone cord, and he fell down. There was an audible gasp from the congregation. Pastor Waite delayed for one brief moment before reaching to help him up. It was long enough to convince those close to the front that their pastor had indeed pushed down Ray Bryson. Ray must have thought so too, because he bounced to his feet and hit the pastor square in the nose with his fist. The lapel mic registered the impact. Flora Waite screamed and ran to help her husband, but she never got close to him. Within an instant, the majority of the congregation converged on the communion table, punching or shoving. Many came down the center of the aisle to help break up the combatants, but remained to fight after their side began to fall behind in the skirmish. The melee soon spilled over into the open space beside the organ. Two tenors and a baritone jumped over the wooden railing of the choir loft and began exchanging punches with members of both sides of the aisle. Mary Dahl, the director of the Dorcas Society, threw a hymnal at one of the tenors, but the missile sailed high and wide and splashed down the baptistry behind the choir. Cheryl Carlson had given up on the organ and moved to the piano, where she tried to restore order by playing Blessed Be the Tie That Binds. Ann Fowler, Frank's wife, told her to return to her seat. When Ray Bryson's right hook finally took the pastor down, someone grabbed the spring flower arrangement from the altar and threw it high in the air in Ray's direction. Water sprinkled everyone in the first two rows on the right side, and a visiting Presbyterian experienced complete immersion when the vase shattered against the wall next to his seat. The fight ended when the police arrived at the scene. They restored order, took down names for a report they would file, and recommended that some of the men seek medical attention. Ray Bryson's hand was broken, and Mary Dahl's knitting needles were confiscated. The following Wednesday, each of the deacons received a notice to appear at the Newton Courthouse for a hearing. Pastor Donald Waite had also been summoned. On the day of the hearing, both he and Flora appeared at the courthouse. They sat on one side of the aisle in the hearing room, and the deacons drifted toward the other. When the court officer entered, breaking the uncomfortable silence, Brian McGuire recognized him immediately as David Goldstein, one of the stars on Beth Shalom's softball team. For several minutes, Goldstein looked over the police description in front of him. The one time he looked up, he seemed to focus on the tape on Waite's nose and the cast on Ray's hand. "I know some of you from the softball league," he finally said, removing his glasses to rub the bridge of his nose. We may have had our differences on the ball diamond, but the cause of religion in our city is at stake here. There must be some way you can settle your dispute among yourselves." No one looked at him. "I've been a pastor in the service for many years," said Donald Waite, standing up, "and I've never met a more stubborn-necked people than those in this church." At that, the deacons raised their heads, and Frank squinted in the light, but Waite was just warming up to his theme. "Now, I have been in the way for a long time." In the way of what? Asked Goldstein, and then decided not to wait for the answer. "I'm dismissing this case," he said, rapping his gavel with sudden force on the desk. Waite sat down awkwardly as Goldstein continued. "No charges will be pressed at this point, but I urge you to work this out within your church. Your Jesus Christ may allow this sort of thing in his followers, but the Commonwealth of Massachusetts will not permit fistfights as a regular order of church service." The leadership of Emmanuel Baptist Church filed quietly out to their cars and drove off in different directions. On the back of each car was a bumper sticker declaring, "God is with us at Emmanuel Baptist Church." Now, I know that was somewhat of a lengthy reading, and I hope I didn't bore you too much with it, but it's a story that I think, if even half of it is true, is disturbing. And it's embarrassing. And I think that probably like most conflicts, this is something that probably began in a place where it could have been fixed long before it ever reached that. That if somebody had talked to someone, if somebody had not died on the wrong hill, if someone had assumed the best, if other people had taken some people alongside and tried to give them guidance and counseling. There are so many ways that this could have probably been avoided. And I say that because I don't think we have any major conflicts in our church at all. But I am saying that all the enemy needs is just one little one. And if left to itself, to metastasize into something that could be really destructive down the road, that we have an obligation as a church, as believers. And that's what Paul is saying here in Philippians, and I'm going to finally get to that. Those of you who are visiting, you may not know, but I don't always start the service like this. I just am today because I think the text is primary when it comes to a message or a sermon, and so I want to get to that now. So just keeping in mind then that the overarching theme in chapter 2 is a call to unity and oneness through obedience to Christ-like humility. So if you could take me back to that slide, Jordan, or not Jordan, I'm sorry, Austin. Oh, the overarching theme of chapter 2 is a call to unity and oneness through obedience to Christ-like humility. That Christ-like humility requires obedience. That the same humility that Christ has, he expects us to have. And we have that humility not as something, it's not something that just exists, but it's something that is expressed, that is practiced in the lives of other people. That we not only lead with love and we lead with joy, as Paul talks about in Philippians, but the humility is one of those things in the Christian life that we should be known for. And not a false humility, but a humility that really expresses our lives in such a way that we consider each other better than ourselves. That we deny ourselves in many ways so that other people can be served. So anyway, let's turn to Philippians chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. And I'm just going to, so what I've done is I went over this a different way last week, and I'm going to go over it a different way this week. And what I've tried to do is subtitle each of the text for us to grasp what's going on here. And then I'm going to spend a little bit of time on the idea of the word emptying, the kenosis idea, because it's important to understand that within the whole of the teaching of this particular chapter. So the Apostle Paul in verse 1 is saying, if you have participated in these following things, verse 1, so if there's any encouragement in Christ, if you have been encouraged in Christ, if any comfort from love, if you have been comforted by the love of Christ, if you have participated with the Spirit, if the Holy Spirit lives in your life, if you have received any affection and sympathy from God, if you have participated in any of those kinds of things, in essence, if you are a Christian that has received the blessing of God, he goes on to verse 2 and says, complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind. So the same mind that Christ, so complete my joy by being of the same mind. I want you all to think alike on these issues. Having the same love. I want you to have the same kind of profound love for one another that you would model after Christ. Being in full accord. So you are completely unified. You all agree and of one mind. Then he goes on to say, in verse 3, always be aware of your motivation when interacting with others. So if you have participated in these things in Christ, I want you to have this kind of a mind. And I want you, and as you have that kind of a mind, I want you to be aware of your motivation when interacting with others. And if you are honest with yourself, and I am honest with myself, we all know that motivation is an everyday factor in terms of how we deal with people. And then in many cases, the reason why the purpose behind our motivation, usually on some level, to some degree, there's some kind of self-service involved. I am doing this thing and it looks really nice outwardly, but deep inside, I know that I might benefit from it in some way. If we're honest with ourselves, we know that's true. Whether it's because something material might come our way, some kind of an accolade might come our way, people might see us as being kinder and more generous, or whatever it is, what is our real motivation? Why do we really do what we do? And that's what he's asking here. So keep in mind, there are these two house churches with Yodia and Syntyche, and there's conflict between them. And so whatever's going on in that dynamic, he's encouraging them to check their motivation. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. So everyone in this room, whenever we interact with each other, the Apostle Paul is saying, we treat each other as if the other person is more significant than what we are. Now imagine what that dynamic might look like. There are 75 people here this morning. Imagine what that dynamic would look like if it were in full force, full action every day that we met here or that we encountered each other out in the public somewhere. That we treated each other as if the other person was more significant. Do you remember the Looney Tunes cartoons with the two chipmunks? Remember that? And they were insufferably polite with each other. Do you remember that? And so this predator would be chasing them. And there could only be they'd come to the hole in the ground to escape. And he would say, after you. No, 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 after you. No, I insist, after you. No, really, after you. You remember that? Okay? And you're meanwhile, there's this dog or cat or whatever bearing down on them. But they were just insufferably polite with each other. It's sort of like that. That we don't, and it's not a matter of trying to out-nice each other so that we accrue for ourselves a reputation. It's simply that we are concerned about the well-being of this other person and how can we be a blessing to them even as they are trying to be a blessing to us. Would that be a bad world to live in? Would that be a bad place for us to be? No, not at all. There's a reason why Friedrich Nietzsche said that the basic drive in all humankind is the will to power. So Friedrich Nietzsche, who was one of the dominant philosophers of the 19th and 20th century, believed that the basic drive in humanity was the will to power, that what we were trying to accrue for ourselves was more and more power so we could have more and more influence, so we could have more and more stuff. And I don't think he's that far off. In fact, I think Friedrich Nietzsche has the heart and the mind and the spirit of Satan himself when he says that. Because I think Satan rebelled against God because he wanted more power. He wanted more influence. He wanted more accolades. He wanted what God had, but without the character of God itself. So there's a lot of ways in which we live our lives, and we do it unwittingly, where we don't imitate Christ so much as we imitate his adversary, when we don't seek the best interests of the other person in our lives. So this is an intense teaching. And it really is the kind of teaching that should fundamentally change the life and the nature of any church, of any Christian that you know. So, moving on. The interests of others is never, and I know for you grammaticians here, that I'm using a double negative, but I did it intentionally. Okay, Dina, I know, so I see it. And because she might draw it to my attention later. The interests of others is never not a primary consideration. There is never a time when we do not have the interests of others. Now, there is a balance here. Well, let me just read this and then we'll go on. Let each of you look not only to the interests of his own interests, but also to the interests of others. I'll read that again. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Now, he is not saying that I look exclusively to the interests of others without considering my interests as well. He is not saying that. These things are in balance. They hold in tension. My mother-in-law, who is a wonderful person, probably failed on the side of seeing to the interests of others before she saw to the interests of hers or even her family's at times. And I think that was a difficult thing for them. But I mean, I think she tried so hard to live this out that she probably did it too much. And when you do that, then you cause resentment in the other people's lives to whom you should have an interest as well, family members and things like that. So there's a balance here. You know what? It requires thought. It requires practice. It means that you have to think about how you're going to live your life and what our priorities really are. And I'm saying that because I think that most Christians think that the Christian faith ought to be easy to live by. and it's not. We are trying to change so much about our nature that the world considers to be normal, that it's hard for us to live with that kind of self-critique. But living with that self-critique, we must. And we have to find a way to practice these principles in a balanced sort of manner. The Lord does not require of us that we surrender all those other things that we are responsible for and that are dependent on us for something else that's out there. We do what we can for those things that are out there while at the same time rationally and reasonably seeing to it our responsibilities to the other things we have that we are responsible for as well. Our spouses, our children, our jobs, things like that. So let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also, not instead of, but also to the interests of others. Verse 5, we must have the mind or heart of Christ. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ. Have this same mind that Christ has. Verse 6, Christ did not keep his form only to himself. And so I'll explain what I mean by that, because now we're getting into this sort of this kenosis thing that I want to talk to you about. Verse 6, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped. This is a text that many people find to be very confusing, and so I want to unpack it for you. All right. The word form here is the true and exact nature of something, possessing all the characteristics and qualities of something. So who, though he was in the form of God, he had the true and exact nature of God himself, Jesus did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped. And that word grasped does not mean understood. That's how people read that. It does not mean understood. So keep in mind then that having the form of God means the having equality with God. And that this text here, as we go on to the next verse, this text, who though he was in the form of God and did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, should be read and contrasted with what he says in the next verse, that Jesus comes as the form of a servant. Here's God. And here's a servant. So in essence, in verse 6, he's saying this. Remarkably, Christ did not imagine that having equality with God, which he already possessed, should lead him to hold onto his privileges at all costs. In other words, he did not count equality with God a thing to hold on to for his benefit only. He was willing to set aside, not eliminate, set aside some of his privileges as God in order to serve us. So he wasn't grasping or holding on to them for himself, but they should be shared or set aside for the benefit of others. Go on to the next slide, because this is really what I want you to get from verse 6. Remarkably, Christ did not imagine that having equality with God, which he already possessed, should lead him to hold on to his privilege at all costs. It was not something to be grasped, to be kept and exploited for his own benefit or advantage. Instead, he had a mindset of servant, of service. Does this make sense to you? Okay? So, then we come to verse 7. Where Paul says, but he emptied himself, he became submissive by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. And so this idea of kenosis means to empty yourself, and you can understand it in that way. And indeed, that's how most of the church interpreted this passage for almost 2,000 years. But it should and could be read as a metaphor. So as a metaphor, basically it means he set aside his privileges, his rights. Jesus Christ set aside his privileges and his rights so that in doing so, he could do what he did for us in order to become human, fully human. He had to set aside certain things that he enjoyed in heaven to be here with us. And he was willing to do that. So I've used this example before. I'll say it again. So imagine that you had the ability to create a life form. And imagine the life form that you had the ability to create was a slug. Where I live in Ambridge on our block, we seem to have a proliferation of slugs. I mean, you can hardly walk down that sidewalk any night without seeing one about this big. Real thick, but as gross as they are, if anybody here had the ability to create one in and of yourself, that would be a phenomenal thing, right? It's a life form. So let's say you created one or a group of them, and let's say they didn't get along very well with each other and that they couldn't fix themselves, that they were really corrupt and damaged, but you wanted them to live in harmony with themselves and with you. And you're like, what can we do with these slugs? Right? Because they're like putting salt on each other, drowning each other in beer, all that kind of stuff. What can we do with these slugs, right? And so you decide, well, in order to fix these slugs, what I have to do is I have to become a slug. So remembering all of the privileges and the rights that you have as a human being, you choose to set aside huge portions of your humanity. You can still access them anytime you want to, but you set them aside in order to become a slug, to save your slugs. Now, I'm not saying that you're slugs in comparison to God, but you get my point. So you can still remember what it's like to be human. You still have access, if you want, to all the privileges of being a human, but you choose to set them aside in order to help these slugs that you created. I mean, actually, the suffering of Jesus began when he became an infant Jewish boy because he could remember what it was like to be God the Son with all the rights and privileges. But he denied himself in that way. That's what that text means. Now, this is a text that historically has caused a lot of consternation because people used this text to call into question the omniscience of Jesus, the omnipotence of Jesus. Was he really co-equal with the Father? How are we to understand this text? And so for them, how many of you have ever, maybe I shouldn't ask, but in our life, we've had a mortgage and we've had a second mortgage. And whenever we wanted to sell our house, even though we had two mortgages, and even though we have the first mortgage, which is how we bought the house, and a second mortgage to do whatever we wanted to with what we wanted to do with that money for, when we wanted to sell our house, the second mortgage becomes the first mortgage. You have to pay off the second mortgage before you can pay off the first mortgage, right? For many theologians, this word kenosis becomes the second mortgage. They just can't get past it. And when they can't get past it, they can't get past what Paul was really calling us to in chapter 2. They're so obsessed with something that really isn't there that they miss the point and the meaning of the entire chapter itself. The context of the chapter, and I'm going to get to this in a minute, has more to do with unity and oneness, and Paul using that word to get us to that. I wanted to share that with you so that you understood and knew what's really going on here. Now, keep this in mind. Many people think that we are human beings having a spiritual experience. We are not. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. I got to be a little careful with that because I don't want to create a dualism here, but you are primarily a spiritual being. You happen to live in a body that's a human body. You happen to live in a place where humanity exists. But at the end of the day, what stands before God and what basks in the joys and the glories of heaven, it's your spirit. It's your soul. It's not your body. And so when Jesus died on the cross and emptied himself, when Jesus came as a Jewish human baby, I'm just not very articulate this morning. When Jesus came as a Jewish baby, a human, he set aside his godliness, a lot of his godly privileges, so that he could die on the cross in our stead. So if I just want to spend just a few minutes, I just want to spend a couple minutes on this so that you get what I'm getting at. So Austin, the slide says emptying theory not in keeping with. If you could turn to that slide. I just want to say this because this is a big deal in some theological circles. The emptying or kenosis theory is not in keeping with the book of Philippians itself. It's not in keeping with early Christian theology. It is not saying that Christ became less than God, which is what some people think. It is not saying that Jesus gave up his divine attributes. He did not do that. He could access them anytime he wanted. It is not commenting on whether he lost his omnipotence or his omniscience. He did not. And it's not saying that Christ gave up being in the form of God. What Paul is saying is that Jesus had all the privileges as king of the universe, and he gave them up to be an ordinary Jewish baby bound for the cross. Christ emptied himself by taking on the form of a servant, born in the likeness of men. He had every right to stay in heaven in a position of power and privilege. 2 Corinthians says this, though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you by his poverty might become rich. That's what happened. That's what Paul was talking about in Philippians chapter 2, verse 7. That he was rich in his privileges, his attributes, yet for his sake he became poor. He set them aside, so that by setting them aside and becoming impoverished like us, we through him might become rich like he really is, so that we will be glorified. And we have that to look forward to in our lives. So Paul is saying this, the manner in which we live with and treat others must be done in the same way that Christ lived with and treated us. The manner in which we live with and treat others must be done in the same way that Christ lived with and treated us. So if Paul is willing to do this, if Christ is willing to do what he did, where he denied himself a vast amount of his privileges to become like us so that we might benefit, who are we to say that we cannot deny ourselves so that others in our lives might benefit? But say that we do, don't we? Struggle with that, we do, don't we? And when we don't struggle with those things as much, when we do consider each other as more important than ourselves, then it says something to the world. And so whatever issues go on in our lives between us and our family, or in our lives between us and fellow church members, it's incumbent upon us to solve them and to fix them to the best of our ability. And the more we do that, the less we give the enemy a foothold to create a wedge to embarrass not only us, but to embarrass Christ. Those words that I read you from that story, your Jesus Christ might allow you to do those things in your houses of worship, but the state of Massachusetts will not allow fistfights to be a regular part of worship. That's a rather extreme example. But you and I both know that we live in a world that looks for anything to discredit anything that wants to set it, that sets a high bar for itself. We live in that world. And we can't give them food. We can't feed that. We can't allow that to happen. So I am not speaking between the lines here. I'm just giving you what I think the standard teaching of this text is, and the application of what it means for you and for me. So going back to Philippians 2:6, look not only to your own interests, but to the interests of others. Have this in mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus. Now, I would just in closing, I would be remiss if I say this. I myself have experienced so many times in the life of this church people who treated me better than they treated themselves. And my life and my wife's life and my children's lives have been so blessed because of that. And I could never thank you enough. And I need to say this. I could never thank you enough for how many of you have been a blessing to me in that way. As a pastor and as a person who I think have a fairly good pulse of the people in our church, I have seen you treat each other in magnificent ways. I've seen you deny yourself, take precious time and effort and energy and resources, and you have blessed people in ways that no one else knows about, but I know a lot of that. But that doesn't mean we're finished, that we can't do still better, that we can't reach higher and work a little harder in that way. We can, and I believe that we will.